University of Waterloo, talking about dynamics of the magnetic susceptibility deep in the Coulomb phase of the dipolar spin ice material holmium titanate.
Does that work?
Okay. Okay, so this is my list of collaborators. I got the samples from Hannah Dubovska and Bruce Golan, and the people in my group are here. I can show you pictures. So Jeff Quilliam was working on my group and is now graduated and is working in France as a postdoc with an Ansric fellowship. People working on this experiment are, there's a handoff from Jeff to Luke on the susceptibility measurements, and he finished off the susceptibility measurements for this, and Hallie Raffel, I'll be showing some work that she's done on susceptibility with squids. Okay, so we heard an introduction to this system, and what I'll be talking about is the susceptibility measurements, and after the important specific heat measurements in theory, for understanding spin ice, another important piece to this system understanding is the susceptibility measurements. And after these were done, and I'll be showing you in a bit more details of it, but basically that was done in 2001, and then more recently, Gilbert and Holdsworth did a theoretical analysis, or basically re-looking at the susceptibility measurements and looking at the time constant of the system and how it slows down with temperature. And what they found was that it was this deviation in the susceptibility, this time constant, as a function of temperature, could be explained by a picture of monopoles. And zooming in on this, you can see the experimental data, and this would be basically what Arrhenius behavior that you would expect with a simple model. And then with a more complicated model using dynamics and using a picture of monopoles, they could fit the experimental curve. And so what I'll be talking about is that us measuring a similar material, not dysprosium titanate, but holmium titanate, and seeing whether we can remeasure this, see the same behavior, but also extend it to lower frequencies. So this is a time constant of 1 hertz. And our goal is to work to lower frequencies where the theory between maybe what's more conventional and what really happens or is more significant. Okay, so this is the original work Matsuhira and also Snyder simultaneously, more or less simultaneously, did this susceptibility work. And this is the results they had. So this is Matsuhira's data. What they found was this is chi prime, which is the in-phase susceptibility. It's basically a measure of the magnitude of the moments that are in phase with an excitation. So what you do is you have an AC field, and you oscillate it at a certain frequency. And if you're oscillating slow enough, then the magnetic moments in the material will be able to track without any problem. And as you cool it, then the magnetization will increase. You'll get more signal. But what happens is if you have maybe a spin glass or spin ice material, this system could slow down. And then what happens is your AC signal will be too fast for those magnetic moments. They'll lag behind. And then you get a out-of-phase term, which is a chi double prime. And so what they're doing here is they measured the temperature dependence of the dysprosium titanate for different frequencies. And what you can see is very low frequencies, the chi prime follows kind of like a 1 over T dependence down to lower temperatures. But if you go to high frequencies, for example, 10 kilohertz, the chi prime, the magnetic moments can't keep up. And so then they lose signal. You get a chi double prime peak here. And then what happens, it didn't go out completely. So there's another mode where basically some magnetic moments still exist, and they start increasing in signal until they freeze out. So there's really two different time constants at which they can see a freezing out or a slowing down of the time constant of the magnetic moments. And so what Matsuhira did was they chose the peak in the data here peaks, and they determined that as a characteristic temperature and frequency for this material. And so they can pick up a high temperature and a low temperature a transition at high. And what happens is as you cool it, so this is 1 over T, as you cool it, what happens is they can see basically a Arrhenius type behavior here at high temperatures, and in another Arrhenius behavior at low temperatures. And then there's kind of a plateau over here. Okay, so now this is collecting the data for dysprosium titanate, holmium titanate, and this material over here. What happens is this is the Snyder data and the Matsuhira data combined, and we can see that there's a lot of different kinds of temperature dependence. And in the original paper by Gilbert and Holdsworth, they were doing a fit to this data over here. This is the Snyder data, which goes over the largest frequency. And the part that's really deviating at the low temperatures, this part over here, they found that instead of following Arrhenius behavior that they'd or you'd maybe expect, it was the energy barrier was maybe 3 times larger. Okay, now this data here, this is done with this keeping a frequency constant at sweeping temperature, and these over here are taken by keeping the temperature constant and sweeping the frequency. And so I'm going to show you in this talk the difference and why you get deviations in the time constant depending on how you make this measurement. Okay, another aspect, so the goal is to make this measurement, understand and get a good accurate quantitative value for the time constant for the material, and also go to lower frequencies. What these measurements were done, the other measurements were done with, well, maybe they used a magnetometer, like a torsional cantilever. Another method of making a measurement is with a solenoid. And the problem with the solenoid is that at low frequencies, the signal, the induced voltage due to the susceptibility of the material goes proportional to the frequency. So when you start going to low frequencies, you start losing signal. And so this type of measurement has a problem when you start going to low frequencies. So if we wanted to go to millihertz instead of hertz, we would lose a factor of 1,000 in signal. So what we do instead is we're using a squid. Now, squid is very nice in that what happens is it provides a signal that is proportional to the flux that it sees. So we can set up a sample and send the magnetic signal to it, and it doesn't have a penalty for going to lower frequencies. And so not only does it not have a penalty, but what it means also is that there's no change in the gain, and so it's linear, and so it's very straightforward to interpret the signal from your sample. You don't have to divide by frequency. There's also the inductance is very small, so in principle can go to very high frequencies without any resonances. And so this is basically a squid is 2 Josephson junctions in a loop, and what happens is that basically looks like a single junction that has a magnetic field dependent critical current. So the IV curve of this system looks like this. This is the current to voltage relation. This is a DC squid because what we do is we apply a DC current, and then depending on the flux that's in there, that determines the circulating current within this loop. It alters the effective critical current, the critical current that you'd measure in the lab, from a high value to a low value. So a change in flux will change the voltage that the device is producing. It'll go from V1 to V2, okay? And so if you optimally bias the current here, you'll get a sinusoidal wave here that in voltage that is modulated with the flux that you're applying. So now, the key here is you can make a very sensitive detector if you can then use feedback to focus your point to stay right here, where you have the highest change in voltage for a small change in flux. You wouldn't want to be there, you'll see no voltage. And so this is the optimal point. So what you do is you measure the voltage, you find this optimal point, and you apply an equal and opposite magnetic field to the squid to maintain that point. And you look at the current required to go to that that coil to be able to keep you there. And so this is our susceptometer schematic. We have a squid, and we have a superconducting flux transformer. We have a primary. We put our sample inside the primary. We have two counterwound coils, so they have equal and opposite pickup to this primary. The sample misbalances the pickup on this one, and we end up measuring the difference. These are never exactly perfectly balanced, and the sample is going to misbalance it in any case. So what we have is an extra coil that balances the system. And so we can apply, we have a divider here that we can divide and send some of the current to this balance coil until we see no signal at all. And then as the sample susceptibility changes, we start seeing a difference due to the misbalance. So now this has an advantage because we don't have any penalty in losing signal as a function of frequency. And so really we're limited by the patients and the stability of the lab environment. And so that's a millihertz right now, and we're going to be working at pushing that to lower frequencies. We can go to higher frequencies, except we get concerned about resonances within this primary, and you can get phase shifts, and you can get errors in the signal. The other thing that can happen is that the feedback coil, the electronics here could have a time constant for how quickly this feedback coil can measure this and cancel it. And so at high frequencies and high amplitudes, there can be errors in the system at high frequencies. So this is really has a big advantage working at low frequencies. And in principle, we could go to many megahertz with this. But we have to, in our case, we have to work on this feedback electronics to be able to get to higher frequencies. So this is another thing we're doing with the squids. We've made our own squids here in the group. Halle Ravel, this was her fourth year project. And so she fabricated this niobium squid where we have two counterwound coils. And what we can do is put one sample on one side and then the other side is empty. And these are counterwound. This is the, you could think of this as the primary, or we could put a primary around the whole thing. And then these are the junctions for the squid. And so we can make a mini susceptometer. You can see this is 30 microns, where we can put a sample in there and measure the susceptibility. And so this is the current to voltage characteristics, showing that it's working. And here's the V-phi curve for this device. And so we would do feedback, setting it up right here, and be able to measure the susceptibility. And this is now starting to work. We have some preliminary results. And what we're doing is we just put a sample nearby, and we were able to see that it could measure the susceptibility. But to be really quantitatively accurate and make interpretation easy, what we're doing is we're drilling the hole, it's been done, in the substrate, so we can feed the sample as a needle through the substrate and have it centered right around this coil. Okay, now back to the spin ice. The idea is that the system has an energy to flip the spins, and this is called the J effective. And what you're doing is you're taking this formula here and coming up with just an effective energy that would be required for a spin flip. And these materials have different J effectives. The dysprosium titanate that is in the Joubert Holdsworth interpretation of Snyder's work, that was had a J effective of 1.1. What we decided to do is measure this material with a different J effective and see whether we get the same temperature dependence. So we're, in a way, putting a little bit of a twist. Hopefully it's going to be consistent. Go to a different J effective and see if we get the same energy barrier to relaxation. And so I guess I explained that. There's basically, if we look at this data here, we have this part over here that ends up looking like 6J effective for some reason, but they don't have that much data to work with. And then there's a plateau over here, and then you'd expect maybe a 2J effective for the energy of this, so that's an unusual part. And then there's this high temperature slowing down, and this has an energy barrier of about 200 Kelvin, which is maybe explained by the crystal field energy. And so this is basically the system becoming an Ising system. And then over here, this is where there's a high concentration of monopoles, and then the monopoles are freezing out, and then the concentration of these monopoles is decreasing. And that's the idea behind why this is slowing down like this. Okay, so to be accurate, we were looking at the other people's work, and they didn't seem to do the demagnetization correction on the materials. And this is an important part for getting an accurate chi prime and chi double prime. The geometry of the sample has a real term that is added to the susceptibility, which, if this is a significant number, can end up causing a phase shift, effective phase shift in what you measure. And so your chi prime and your chi double prime can look different. And actually, Matsuhira mentions this in his paper, and for some reason, they say in the first four figures they don't put in the correction, and then later on they do. And so they knew about it, they have these formulas in there, but they didn't use them to analyze the data. And so that part where I'm showing you the graphs before, the time constant as a function of frequency, doesn't take this into account. And it doesn't look like Schiffer, in their work, took this demagnetization correction into account either. And so here's some of our data. And what we're looking at here is for two different temperatures, the chi, and the chi double prime, and for two different geometries, you can see the demagnetization correction can actually significantly change the peak in the chi double prime for the two different geometries of sample we have here. And if we take into account the demagnetization correction, a perfect needle would have a signal that would look like that. And for this temperature here, it would look like that. So we could, what we do is we take two different samples, we take into account the demagnetization correction, we also look at the coupling between our sample and the squid, and then we can then make a prediction of what the ideal sample would look like. And so this is our results of the chi prime and the chi double prime as we go to lower temperatures. So blue is cold and red is hot, and so we see the system slowing down, and we have two different needle geometries, and so far that looks good. We then looked at the chi double prime. What you can do is you can normalize the chi double prime as a function of frequency, both normalize the amplitude and center it around a frequency on a log graph. And what you can see is the shape is not very nicely behaved, or you know, it doesn't have some simple behavior to it. And actually, there's a crossing over here where as you cool it, it's actually getting narrower, similar to maybe you know, very, very subtly compared to what was happening with the anti-glass system of holmium and trimethylene fluoride. And then over here, when we take the demagnetization correction, we end up straightening things out and making things look a little bit, you don't have this crossing over here. Now, this is the data of the chi prime as a function of temperature, where we measured it similar to what Matsuhira did. And what he did, or they did, was they fixed the frequency and swept the temperature, and they saw when the magnetic material was not able to keep track with the frequency you're applying, and then look at the peak in the chi double prime. The problem with doing it this way is basically a convention of why are you saying the time constant is equal to the peak in the chi double prime. In this case here, the material is getting colder, so the susceptibility of this material is becoming larger. And so this is actually skewing the shape of this. Okay, and if you're very cold, then the percentage change in the susceptibility from this side to here is significant. And so it's going to end up changing the meaning of this peak here. While when you're at higher temperatures, the change in the susceptibility over that temperature range is not so significant. And so that curve doesn't get as distorted. And so you're going to end up having a temperature-dependent shift in what this peak means. And so it's kind of an arbitrary value to be attributing to this peak here. And it's also, you could see, because the shape of this is changing with temperature, it's going to be affected by the shape of that. So if you do the frequency spectrum, we can see that this is more or less symmetric. And so maybe using the peak frequency for scanning the frequency instead of temperature is a little bit more consistent. And so then this is our data. And what we can do is a fit. And we see that as a function of frequency and 1 over temperature, that we get Arrhenius behavior. This is the equation. And we get a barrier that's very, very close to 6J effective. And that's what Holdsworth and Gilbert in their paper found with a very small amount of data. They had data only going down to 1 hertz, down to here, and but it ends up quantitatively being the same. And then, so if we now add our data to everybody else's, what we see is the Schiffer data here going down. This is for the dysprosium titanate, and for our holmium titanate, we have a qualitatively similar behavior and a very nice straight line over a large range, so we can make a good convincing fit to Arrhenius. Okay, well, that's it, actually. And so I just want to say that we basically measured a different material with a different J effective, and we find that it also has a J effective, a 6 J effective for the barrier at low temperatures. And the understanding for why that is, I don't know, maybe some of the experts in the room will know. And the next thing to do is to go back to the DTO, which has a smaller frequency and temperature range of study, and redo that and check to see that it's consistent. We also are working on higher accuracy measurements at lower and higher frequencies. Thanks a lot.
Questions, comments?
Okay. He's getting the microphone.
I mean, your J effective is the first nearest neighbor cutoff for your dipole interaction, right? Do you also consider the energy contribution from spins beyond first nearest neighbor?
I mean, all I'm doing is making a measurement of the susceptibility. And so the theoretical side of things is there. Basically, I'm not taking it into account because I'm not taking any of that into account. Are you saying in what I'm calling J effective?
Yeah, the 6 J effective. The Arrhenius law describes the, you need the energy barrier to create a spin flip, but your J effective only consider the nearest neighbor interaction. This system has actually have a dipole interaction,
okay,
but you cut it in the first nearest neighbor. You also consider the contribution from, say, interactions beyond first nearest neighbor?
No. So all we're doing is just taking that one simple term and doing a fit to see what it's going to be and seeing if it's constant. And that's one of the things, is to go to lower frequencies and temperatures and seeing whether it actually holds. So I would just say right now that we're getting a slope. I mean, more importantly, forgetting about 6 J effective, all we're saying is that this energy barrier seems to be 10.7 Kelvin. And so if the theorists want to come up with, if there's a significance to that and what they could do with it, then that's great.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think there was a question on the far side.
Oh, that's because we're at much, much lower temperatures. So if, let me see if, whoops, uh-oh, what was that? I pressed the square button.
I guess we ran out of time.
Right. What we need to do is we need to work on improving our frequency at higher frequencies. Okay, so what happens is we can't measure. I would say that, you know, we can measure it, but it probably won't be right. Above, let's say, a kilohertz. Above a kilohertz, we start seeing deviations that, you know, if we're looking for gross effects, we'd be fine with. But if we want to do anything with high precision, we'd have problems. And so it's really close to that. That's it right there. We can measure up to around here. And with some work, and it's going to be straightforward, we should be able to get to 10 kilohertz or 50 kilohertz. And then we can get this last part here. So it's not the temperature is the problem. It's really the frequency. And so we haven't seen that. But I'm pretty confident that that this is going to be right. I don't think that's a problem. So it's the feedback electronics. We've put a lot of time into the susceptometer, and we're pretty confident that that's right. Depending on how we tune the squid, if we tune everything right, we can get more bandwidth out of it. And so we need to do a little bit more work on this open loop gain, increase the open loop gain to give us more improved frequency. We could also lower the closed loop gain of the squid controller, and that'll give us the bandwidth. So it's pretty straightforward. We know what we need to do. It's in the squid feedback loop to get the extra frequency.
Okay, any further questions, comments? Well, if not, thanks very much, John.